Today is Wednesday, February 21st. We're going to work on blood pressure regulation and bulk fluid transport of the capillaries. Okay, so on the middle of page 52, we're going to pick up with blood pressure information. I'm going to start you off with just a definition for blood pressure. We know that blood pressure is a force that pushes blood through the vessels, and the primary force for systemic circulation is the force of the left ventricle contracting. At the height of systolic contraction, what is the pressure coming from the left ventricle?
High.
Good. So about 110, 120 millimeters of mercury. So that force is what helps to keep blood circulating throughout our vessels. It is the contraction of the heart, and most specifically, it's that left ventricle that's contracting. All right, so you probably are familiar with this from lab. Those measurements for blood pressure are taken in millimeters mercury. That is mmHg. This graph is in your course pack. It is actually on the top of page 53. And I'm going to flip you back and forth between the questions on the bottom of 52 and this graph on the top of 53. You'll notice that the blood pressure on the y-axis here ranges from 0 to about 120 millimeters mercury. And we're looking at the blood vessels that blood passes through in systemic flow. We know that the blood passes from the aorta to arteries to arterioles, then the capillaries, venules, and veins. And eventually we end up back in two large veins, superior and inferior vena cava. All right, so in the aorta, you'll notice that we've got, you know, a systolic pressure around 120 and a diastolic pressure around 80. I know you've talked about the mean arterial pressure in lab, and you'll notice that that's the highest in the aorta. So the highest blood pressure is experienced by the aorta. Okay, that is a question in the bottom of page 52. The highest blood pressure. Yeah, the highest BP is in the aorta. Your aorta is about the size of your thumb in terms of diameter. That's a pretty big vessel. And so if you've got pressure higher than 120, what do you think it does to the walls of that vessel?
Stretches
them, right. So my dad had vomiting that would not go away about 5 years ago. My dad's in his 80s. And so, you know, endless vomiting is not a good thing for an elderly person. So he went and had, you know, a scan done of the abdomen just to check and see if there was something going on with the digestive organs. Digestive organs were fine. It was apparently a 24-hour bug, something of that sort. It eventually went away. But what they noticed from that scan was something else they weren't even looking for, and that was an aortic aneurysm in the abdominal aorta. Like I said, the aorta is supposed to be about thumb width. His was three times as wide. That's about this wide. So, you know, they have to do surgery to repair that aneurysm if you've got a wall that continues to be stretched. And yeah, he had a history of high blood pressure and smoking, so that contributes to that stretch, that damage done to that aorta. If an aneurysm ruptures, you can bleed out and die in under 5 minutes. So that's why an aneurysm that is stretched that far has to be treated, you know, immediately. So that's why that aorta has to be an elastic artery. What does it have in its tunica media? What do elastic arteries have in their tunica media? Not as much smooth muscle, but a lot of elastic. Yeah, a lot of elastic fibers. And just like we've talked with underwear, you want to have it stretch, but you also want to have it recoil. Okay? So that's the key here, is we want to have stretchy but able to recoil back to its original shape after blood passes through. We know those elastic arteries are the ones closest to the heart because they experience the stretch of pressure. In fact, you'll notice that they experience the pulsation of diastolic or systolic pressure. Muscular arteries are the ones that conduct blood to our body parts, and they're the ones with a lot of smooth muscle in the walls. Why is it important to have smooth muscle in some of our arteries?
Because of that high pressure.
Yeah, you can constrict them. That regulates blood flow to a particular area. Or if necessary, you can dilate them and increase blood flow. So those arteries are the ones that we often feel our blood pulse, you know, our pulse in. And then finally, we get to these arterioles, and you'll notice that we no longer experience that pulsation of systolic pressure or diastolic pressure. We get just a steady blood flow in those vessels. Also, notice the big steep drop-off here in blood pressure in the arterioles. What has changed about that vessel from those arteries? They are smaller. Good. So you have large diameter inside those arteries, and then all of a sudden you move into those arterioles and the diameter shrinks. Since the blood is not being pumped any harder, that means that the blood force or the pressure is going to drop. That takes you back to the bottom of 52 with another question. The steepest drop off or decline in blood pressure occurs where? In the arterioles. So steepest drop in BP, that is in the arterioles. Well, we took a nosedive from somewhere in the, looks like in the 80s here, the arterioles, down to the mid-30s. That's a pretty hefty decline. Once we get to the capillaries, you'll notice that we see another drop-off. We go from the mid-30s down to the mid-teens, and we continue to see a decline in blood pressure as we enter venules and veins. So in thinking about this blood flow, we started at the heart with the aorta. We traveled through arteries and arterioles, capillaries and venules, and we're getting farther and farther from the force of the heart's contraction, and you'll notice the blood pressure continues to drop. So even though the vena cava are pretty large in diameter, there's just not any push lift behind those vessels. Therefore, what is the pressure in your vena cava? Zero, right? So you've run out of gas by the time you get to this point. There is no longer any force behind this blood, and so therefore we see even a negative pressure in those vena cava. We have such low blood pressure by the time we've made it that far. All right, so that should take you down there to the bottom of that page. All right, so just a take-home message about this one, a couple of things to pay attention to. Aorta has the highest pressure. The biggest drop-off in pressure is in your arterioles. And where do you have pretty much no pressure?
Vena cava.
Vena cava, good. So by the time you're there, you're at about zero or less. We've talked about this graph before. In fact, it was back in the heart chapter when we talked about systolic pressure and diastolic pressure. Just a great time for us to repeat this once again. Normal blood pressure should be around 110 to 120 millimeters mercury. That is a systolic number. Over about 70 or 80, that's a pretty good diastolic number. What numbers say that we are now into hypertension? Yeah, 140 over about 90, yeah. And then if we're talking about hypotension or low blood pressure, our low numbers are
80.
Yeah, 80 over 60. So we're looking at those numbers or lower, creating problems delivering oxygen to our cells and tissues. All right, so on page 53, below the picture, there's a couple of bits there about cardiac output, blood pressure, and peripheral resistance. Before we head into that, let me take you back to something we discussed in a previous chapter. In the previous chapter, we talked about this term here, cardiac output. On average, how much blood is that?
5 liters.
About 5 liters, good. And we circulate those 5 liters of blood every minute. So every minute we circulate our cardiac output, that's about 5 liters. We know cardiac output depends on two factors or variables. So what is HR?
Heart rate.
Good. And an average number for us?
60
to 100. Good. So we know that heart rate is around 60 to 100 beats per minute. We said 75 on average. And then we also know that stroke volume here is about how many milliliters? About 70, good. And so how would you define stroke volume? You're on the right track. Amount of blood being pumped from your ventricles out of the heart. Good. So each ventricle pumps out 70 milliliters. That is our stroke volume. So with every heartbeat, you're going to pump out 70 mils from each ventricle. Okay. So we know that those two variables, heart rate and stroke volume, are directly related to our cardiac output. That means if one value goes up, the other values are going to go up. So if heart rate increases, cardiac output should also increase. We're going to hold that thought and now come down here to this. We now know that blood pressure depends primarily on cardiac output. In fact, cardiac output is the main number one determinant of blood pressure. So that's on your worksheet. It's underlined. You may want to highlight that or circle it. Okay, so cardiac output is our main determinant of blood pressure. So how much is that? Yeah, or cardiac output,
five liters.
And of those 5 liters, about 55% of your blood is what?
Plasma.
Good. And the other 45%? Red blood cells. Good. If I said, can you change your red blood cell number right now? Can you do that? Not right this minute. Can you change the amount of plasma you're circulating in the next 5 to 10 minutes? Yeah. What can you do?
Start drinking water.
Exactly. So if you drink water or fluids, you're going to change your ratio of plasma to red blood cells. And most importantly, you can increase your cardiac output. So if you're feeling lightheaded or feel like your blood pressure is low, we know that drinking fluids is one quick and easy way to alter your cardiac output and increase your blood pressure. You know, decreasing your blood pressure is a little harder. You can't just automatically make your kidneys flush out your fluids. But, you know, if need be, we can take medications like diuretics and beta and alpha blockers and even ACE inhibitors and can help flush out those fluids. So fluids are the number one way to increase your cardiac output. PR is not Puerto Rico. It is peripheral resistance. And there's 3 forms of resistance to blood flow. So let's talk through those. Okay, so in terms of resisting blood flow, the thickness of your blood, the length of your vessels, and the diameter of your vessels all can impede blood flow through your body. Let's talk through blood thickness or blood viscosity first. So let me give you an example. If you're thinking about drinking a milkshake and you have a really, really thick milkshake to drink versus a running thin milkshake to drink, which one is going to require you more effort to drink through a straw?
The thick one.
Okay, so same concept applies to moving blood. If your blood is thick, meaning it's more viscous, that is going to require your heart to pump harder to push that thick blood through your vessels. So thinking about some things that can increase viscosity or thickness of your blood, which one of these two scenarios, polycythemia or normal blood, would make your blood more viscous and thicker?
Polycythemia.
And what is the problem with that condition?
Too many red blood cells,
right. So the more red blood cells you have, the thicker your blood is, and the harder that heart has to pump to push those cells through the body's vessels. What effect do you think anemia would have on viscosity?
Thinner.
You would have, there's less oxygen. We'll come to that because that is another problem, right? But the fact that your blood is thinner means that your heart's not having to work as hard to circulate those very few cells that you've got.
So it feels flat.
It's more liquid, more fluid-like. Yeah, so it's like circulating water as opposed to circulating syrup. let's look at the other side there. You've got blood cells and blood. You've also got plasma and blood. How could we change your plasma concentration so that you've got thinner blood? Drink more fluids, yeah. So the more fluid you've got in your bloodstream, the more hydrated you are, the more fluid your blood is, and the easier it will flow. But of course, dehydration makes your blood thicker or more viscous because now you've got a higher ratio of what?
Cells in the plasma.
That's right. You've got more cells instead of plasma, and your heart has to work harder to pump that through the vessels. So dehydration can actually make your heart beat faster because, and your blood pressure go up because you're looking at more viscous blood. Okay. Something else that causes resistance to blood flow is vessel length. The longer your vessels, the more your heart has to pump, or harder your heart has to pump to create higher pressure to get that blood through all those vessels. You may have heard that if you lose weight, you can lose mileage of vessels, and that can decrease your blood pressure. So let me put it to you this way. If I offer you a milkshake and I give you the option of taking my drinking straw versus my garden hose, which is going to get you the drink faster? The straw, because it's shorter, right? And if I offer you my garden hose, even with the bigger diameter, you're going to have to work really hard to pull your milkshake through 50 feet. You'll be sitting there a while. Yeah, somebody else will be finished and long gone, right? All right, so right now we have a difficult time really making a difference with viscosity. We also can't change our vessel length right now either because we can't lose or gain weight that quickly. Too bad, right? But this is something you can change right now, and this is vessel diameter. So the vessel diameter is controlled by your brain. And if you need to constrict your vessels, you can do so using sympathetic stimulation from your brain. Let me mention that there is no parasympathetic innervation to your blood vessels. So you can't tell your blood vessels to relax. How do you get them to relax then?
Just by calming down your system.
Meditation, calming yourself down, right? Breathing, making sure that you just stop stimulating the sympathetic nervous system. So eventually, over time, that epinephrine and norepinephrine is not telling your vessels to stay constricted. All right, so the main vessels that we constrict are the arteries and arterioles. Those with muscle tissue in their walls are the ones that we can constrict. Why is it no point in constricting veins if you're trying to maintain blood pressure?
The vein needs to pop.
What pressure does a vein have?
Low pressure.
Low pressure. So if I squeeze a vein with no pressure, I get no pressure, right? So if you want to make a difference in your blood pressure, squeeze those arteries and those arterioles. So just to review, we've talked about these terms before. What is vasoconstriction?
Vessels
squeeze, they tighten up. That smooth muscle in the arteries and arterioles constricts. And when we constrict a vessel, your blood pressure goes up. Okay. And then, of course, vasodilation means the diameter increases, your vessel relaxes open, and your pressure goes down. Okay. So we'll just keep that in mind as we work through the next page or so. Let's see. I should tell you that we're getting ready to talk about ways to control blood pressure. And of the three things that we just discussed, blood viscosity, vessel length, and vessel diameter, the only one that is controlled by your nervous system right now is vessel diameter. And that's what we call the neural control of your blood pressure. If you're ready, I'll take you on over to page 54. How about questions so far?
Vessel diameter. Neural control.
That's right. Neural control is a vessel diameter. We're going to get through neural control first, and then we're going to talk about chemical control and hormonal control. But that stuff's easy because we've already been there and done that in the endocrine chapter. So we'll take the neural control through the vessel diameter first. It's one of their things.
No.
Okay, so we're going to talk about how to control your blood pressure and your heart rate at the same time. I could have done heart rate control back in the previous chapter, but it makes better sense to just do it all at once. So what I want to do is introduce you to a cardiovascular center. In your brain, your medulla oblongata, you have four control centers. The medulla has a control center for vomiting. It has a control center for respiration rates. It also has a cardiovascular center that has two components. One component controls your heart rate, and the other component controls your blood vessel diameter. So right here, we're looking at your medulla oblongata, and we're talking about the cardiovascular center. It controls heart rate, it controls vessel diameter, okay? So that's one thing we want to talk about. The other thing I want to mention is this. You have a sympathetic and parasympathetic connection to your heart. Sympathetic connections tell your heart rate to speed up, and we do so using which neurotransmitters?
Epinephrine.
Good, epinephrine and norepinephrine, good. We also have a connection between your medulla and your heart that can say, hey heart, slow down your rate. That uses which cranial nerve?
The vagus nerve.
And this time, instead of releasing epi and NE, we release
ACH.
Good. So we have both sympathetic and parasympathetic control over the heart. But over these vessels, we only have what kind of control? And not any parasympathetic, right. So let me repeat that. The heart has both sympathetic and parasympathetic control. Okay, heart has sympathetic and parasympathetic, but vessels only receive sympathetic control. There is no parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. Okay, heart has sympathetic and parasympathetic control. Is that what you're going to ask me? Okay, and vessels have only sympathetic control. There is no parasympathetic innervation to your heart, or sorry, vessels. No parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. To maintain homeostasis. That's what we're going to use right now to maintain blood pressure and heart rate. We're going to use your cardiovascular center in your brain to act as a control center. So we're going to start with this picture here first, and I'm going to throw out some scenarios, and we're going to work through how this negative feedback loop is going to work. Okay. So first of all, I know the Olympics are going on right now, and they were talking on the news the other day about how people that are preparing for the Olympics have been sleeping in these like hypobaric chambers. And for those who are in a really high altitude situation, they may want to avoid altitude sickness. So if you've never heard of altitude sickness, it's apparently not a fun thing to experience. You get sick to your stomach, you're lightheaded, and you feel pretty awful until you return back down to a normal altitude. So by sleeping in a climate that's low oxygen, you can actually train your body to acclimatize to a high altitude. So that's one issue here. So let's say that we've got a situation with low oxygen. There are receptors that sit in your aortic arch and your common carotid arteries in your neck. Why put receptors in those locations that detect oxygen levels?
Brain's getting oxygen.
Yeah, brain's got to get oxygen, right? And if those carotids detect low oxygen, then brain, here comes a problem. Okay? So if you have chemoreceptors, figure out that you've got low oxygen level. Those chemoreceptors take that stimulus to the brain. Okay? And to what particular part of the brain will they take that information?
To the medulla.
To the medulla, good. That cardiovascular center is sitting in the medulla, and the medulla makes a decision that says, well, you've told me that you've got low oxygen coming up those common carotid arteries. we need to do something to blood pressure and heart rate. So, how do you increase blood pressure and heart rate?
Turn on the sympathetic
nervous system. Good. And turn off
the parasympathetic.
Yeah, turn on the sympathetic and turn off your parasympathetic. Ramping up the epinephrine and norepinephrine, we're going to turn on sympathetic control, and we're going to decrease parasympathetic control. So let's talk about what your heart and your blood vessels do. What happens to your SA node?
It's going to start firing a lot.
Speed it up, right? Okay, so SA node fires faster. If you fire your SA node faster, you set your pace higher. And what happens to your heart rate?
It's going to increase.
It's going to speed up. Good. So we're going to have a higher heart rate. All right. So that is the job of our sympathetic nervous system, is release epinephrine and norepinephrine onto your SA node. The SA node makes the heart rate increase. And at the same time, because we've ramped up epinephrine and norepinephrine, what happens to your vessels?
Squeeze
them, right? So you vasoconstrict your vessels, and now what happens to your blood pressure?
It goes up.
It goes up. Good. So the bottom line is, why do this?
So to give more oxygen to the body with the limited amount of oxygen that it has.
Good. Get more oxygen out in circulation, make the heart beat faster and the blood pressure go up, and that way you can deliver your small amounts of oxygen out to your cells and tissues. Good. Okay. So this is actually a negative feedback loop. What the response is how we work on this as an effector. That's how we solved the problem, and the problem was low oxygen levels. Let me give you another scenario. Let's say that we've got someone who is exercising. We know that exercise uses oxygen and produces CO2. So if we have a condition known as hypercapnia, which is excess carbon dioxide, that's going to be picked up by a set of receptors in the common carotids in the aorta called chemoreceptors. Chemoreceptors are tattletales. What do they tell the brain? I've got problems, right? What does the brain say we should do about your high carbon dioxide levels?
Get it out of the body.
Get it out of the body. And you do that by doing what to your sympathetic nervous system response?
Increase it.
And you tell your parasympathetic nervous system to?
Take a seat.
All right. Just keep in mind, there is no parasympathetic innervation to where?
To the vessels.
So we're basically decreasing parasympathetic innervation to your heart. We're lowering the amount of acetylcholine that tells your heart rate to slow down. So by speeding up your heart rate and increasing your blood pressure, how do we solve our initial problem of high carbon dioxide? You'd hyperventilate, right? So you get that blood to your lungs more quickly, and in fact, you'll breathe it out more quickly as well. So that'll help you remove that CO2 from your bloodstream. Let's do one more for this side. Let's talk about blood pressure issues. Let's say that you're dehydrated, you haven't had anything to eat or drink today, and if you're dehydrated, your blood pressure is going to be low. With low blood pressure, a different receptor in your common carotids and aorta pick up on this problem, and that is called a baroreceptor. Baro meaning pressure receptor. All right, so those baroreceptors are tattletales. They tell your brain what's wrong, and to increase your blood pressure, What kind of nervous system stimulation do we want to increase?
Sympathetic,
good. And so what happens to heart rate and blood pressure in response?
Just go forward and get higher.
Going to increase up, good. Okay, so let me mention something here that's a commonly missed issue on previous tests. If you have a blood pressure problem, like if you got it this morning, you were crazy busy and you didn't have a chance to eat or drink, does that mean you have any problem with CO2, hydrogen, or oxygen?
No.
So they could be completely normal, right? Okay, so these are mutually exclusive things. You've got blood pressure that can be regulated through this mechanism. Likewise, you can regulate carbon dioxide, oxygen problems, or even blood pH problems through this mechanism. So if you're fixing a blood pressure problem, then there probably was not a problem with your oxygen or CO2. But nonetheless, we have the same response, you know, for all four of those problems sitting right there. Okay, let me give you another set of scenarios. Let's move to this picture over here. Let's say that we've got somebody who had bad stomach bug. This person had experienced a lot of vomiting. Vomiting causes you to lose a lot of hydrogen ions. So what kind of pH imbalance do we have?
It will have to be more basic.
More basic, right. So if you vomit frequently, your blood pH becomes more basic or alkaline. All right, so this time, what kind of receptor picks up on the pH imbalance?
Chemoreceptors,
and they're located where?
In your carotid arteries.
Carotid arteries in your aorta, good. And they tattletale to your medulla oblongata's cardiovascular center. The cardiovascular center is your control center, your decision maker. So what decision are we going to do about this problem?
Put more hydrogens in the bloodstream.
So let's say we've got sympathetic and parasympathetic. How do we want to alter those?
They do the opposite.
They do the opposite. Good. Yes, I think you see the pattern, right? So yeah, you're this time going to take your foot off the gas pedal, lower your sympathetic stimulation to your heart and to your blood vessels. When we increase parasympathetic stimulation, we're only doing so to what part? Just to the heart, right? Okay. So when you increase parasympathetic stimulation, you send the vagus nerve a message to dump more acetylcholine onto that SA node, and in response, your SA node fires slower and your heart rate falls. Okay, and likewise, vasodilation will occur because we're no longer stimulating those vessels to stay constricted, and then blood pressure will fall. All right, so that's one scenario we can look at. You know, the other things that can trigger this particular response would be low carbon dioxide levels, high oxygen levels, and even high blood pressure problems. Okay, so these are negative feedback mechanisms. I wanted to give you guys an opportunity to practice them and try them on your own. So I left you some work on page 55 to try. If you want to work with your seatmate or somebody sitting near you, feel free. And then we're going to do answers together in just a few minutes. Okay, so let's do some answers. We've got the first one done for us on the top of page 55 with high blood pressure. The second one on the top of page 55 is a low blood pressure problem, and the reason given is dehydration. So what I'm looking for in there is something that matches one of my four issues. I'm looking for a hint that tells me it's a carbon dioxide problem, a hydrogen ion or a pH problem, oxygen problem, or blood pressure. And so, voila, that one matches the blood pressure issue. So it happens to be low blood pressure. And the stimulus, of course, is low blood pressure. Okay, the receptor that carries this information back to your brain is what type of receptor?
Baroreceptor,
good. Of course, they're like tattletales. They tell your brain that your blood pressure is too low. And they're like your chemoreceptors in your common carotids and your aortic arch. Now, the control center is your cardiovascular center that's part of your medulla oblongata. And the control center makes a decision that turns on these effectors. And so the decision made by your control center is to increase sympathetic nervous system stimulation and decrease parasympathetic. So the effectors play out the job. They basically carry out the wishes of your control center. So in return, we see your SA node firing faster, that increases heart rate, vasoconstriction will occur, that will increase your blood pressure. Okay, so that's kind of the gist of what the feedback mechanism is for a problem with low blood pressure. Did you more or less get this? Okay, probably the most important part of it is figuring out that you're increasing sympathetic, decreasing para, and that your response is to increase heart rate and blood pressure. Okay, let's try the next one there. High blood pH is the same thing as saying we've got alkalosis. And that is matching my pH problem, okay? So we're gonna look at this one over here because low levels of hydrogens are the same thing as saying we've got an alkaline blood pH. So that's the first battle, is figuring out what the problem is. This patient here has a high blood pH or alkalosis. All right, so what kind of receptors pick up on this problem?
Chemoreceptors.
Chemoreceptors, good. The control center is located where? In the medulla, good. And the decision made by that control center is to do what?
Is to give more hydrogen ions into
the business. Decrease sympathetic, increase parasympathetic, keeping in mind there's only parasympathetic innervation to the heart, okay? And we do this using effectors. We tell the SA node to fire more slowly. That causes heart rate to decrease. And we simultaneously stop stimulating your blood vessels, so eventually what will happen to them?
They relax.
They relax, good, and then blood pressure decreases. Let me make the connection here. If you slow down your heart rate and you lower your blood pressure, your breathing rate's gonna fall as well, and eventually you retain more hydrogens in your blood. And the hydrogen link is to carbon dioxide. That's something we have not yet talked about, but there is a link there to hydrogen concentration and the heart rate, respiratory rate, and blood pressure. Did you do this one okay? Have you had a chance to do the last two yet? Would you like to work on those at home and we'll do those together, give you practice? We can do those together on Monday. Okay. And so instead, let's go ahead and flip on over to page 56. Y'all don't let me forget to go back and hit those answers for you on Monday. Okay, so there's a bunch of practice problems in D2L in the announcements if you would like more practice with this stuff.
All of your YouTube videos, it might just be my computer, but all your videos you post that are like really good videos or helpful, it always says that they're not actual videos. Like they've been taken off YouTube or something.
Oh, that's too bad. Okay.
That might just be mine.
For blood pressure?
Like on your own, this is, these are really useful videos or whatever for animations. None
okay.
of them work.
Okay, I'll go back and see if I can get the link to connect again.
Okay.
Okay. So we're talking about regulating your blood pressure. Your brain plays an important role, but chemicals and hormones can also play a role. So on that page we're looking at now, we've got histamine, we've got things like nitrous oxide and nicotine that can also influence your blood pressure. So let's talk first about histamine, which happens to be a chemical released by which white blood cell? Basophils, good. And when might you release histamine?
Whenever you have a cut or something or abrasion to your skin.
Yeah, anytime you inflame the skin, right? Allergic reactions are a common time. But yeah, anytime you damage your skin or your tissues, histamine can be released. In fact, histamine is partly responsible for the uncomfortable feeling you have when you damage your skin. So that swelling, the pain, the itchiness that may be associated with bug bites or cuts, that's histamine. So histamine happens to be a pretty potent vasodilator, and it can be life-threatening if you happen to have a lot of histamine in your system because it reduces the blood pressure. We call this a form of shock. I know you've probably heard of this one.
Anaphylactic,
that's right. So we take antihistamines to block the release of histamine from basophils. Or what other hormone or neurotransmitter can reverse the effects? Okay, so there's a hormone or a neurotransmitter that can actually block the effects of histamine. People who have very severe allergies carry an EpiPen. Yeah, that's epinephrine. So yeah, epinephrine can reverse the effects if necessary of histamines. Interesting side note about histamines, they're an important brain neurotransmitter. So if you take Benadryl or any of those antihistamines, then you know how sleepy you get. That's because histamine is actually an alertness neurotransmitter in your brain. So kind of an interesting side effect there. Nitrous oxide is something that your blood vessels naturally produce to dilate themselves. If your blood vessels produce nitrous oxide, what happens to your blood pressure?
It's lowers.
Yeah. So blood pressure lowers, you become more relaxed. And in fact, laughing gas at the dentist office is nitrous oxide. That's meant to relax us. They place patients with a pulse oximeter on their finger, because we want to make sure they're getting enough oxygen when they're taking nitrous oxide. So there's certainly a link there between blood pressure and heart rate.
It's certainly funny when they pull it too well.
I have never had laughing gas.
Yeah, they say it numbs the pain and all that's a lie.
No.
You can still feel it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they charge extra.
Yeah. All it does is make you feel like you're drunk or crazy.
So you feel kind of loopy while you're using it?
Yeah, it just makes you feel like you're crazy.
I don't need that. I don't need to step closer that way. You may have heard of puffing. That is using aerosol canisters to inhale their nitrous oxide. The problem with that is you're getting unregulated amounts of laughing gas, and you can pass out or worse yet cause brain damage or die. Let's see. And our last one there, nicotine is found in tobacco products, and of course that is a vasoconstrictor. So that can lead to an increase in blood pressure. All right, down near the bottom of your page, you've got hormonal control of blood pressure. So let's talk about these. This should be a good review for us. So we know that epinephrine and norepinephrine work for which nervous system branch?
Sympathetic,
good. They increase blood pressure. All right. I mentioned to you there a beta blocker, which specifically works against epinephrine and norepinephrine. If you take a beta blocker, what does that do to your heart rate? Decrease it, right, because epinephrine and norepinephrine are blocked from doing their job. We know that antidiuretic hormone also increases blood pressure by water retention. Water retention has a direct impact on blood pressure. Because the more water you keep, what happens to your cardiac output?
It's going to increase,
right. So cardiac output is one thing that we can do. That's the main thing we can do to increase blood pressure. I've got you another question there. It says, why do you think a patient might be given vasopressin, an alternate name for ADH, if they need to increase blood pressure? So let's say that you... They can retain the water. And does ADH do anything directly to your heart? It doesn't. So if you need to increase blood pressure without directly doing something to your heart, that's where vasopressin can be helpful. Okay. So to answer that question, vasopressin only increases blood pressure. Vasopressin only increases blood pressure through water retention. Vasopressin only increases blood pressure through water retention. Okay, vasopressin only increases blood pressure through water retention. Another one that increases blood pressure is angiotensin. We've talked about this one before in relationship to that renin-angiotensin mechanism. By the way, what turns on that mechanism? That's it, kidneys will turn it on, right? When you've got low blood oxygen, or pressure rather. So angiotensin, of course, is part of the mechanism that turns on aldosterone. And so that would be the next step in what we make in order to retain water and sodium. There's a question there on your sheet about an ACE inhibitor drug. These kinds of drugs block the effects of angiotensin II. If you block the effect of angiotensin II, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes lower. Yes, so ACE inhibitors actually cause BP to lower. So blockers like alpha and beta and inhibitors like ACE inhibitors all cause heart rate and blood pressure to drop. Okay, and then finally you've got ANP hormone down there. That is the only one in the list to cause blood pressure to go where?
Down,
yeah. So everything else in that list is a stimulant for blood pressure, except for ANP.
It's crazy that you got all of those to increase blood pressure, only
one to lower. Yeah, no wonder people have blood pressure problems. They got all these chemicals and hormones working together. How about questions so far? Go ahead.
What effect does a beta blocker have on the heart rate and blood pressure?
It lowers heart rate and blood pressure. And it does that by blocking epinephrine and norepinephrine. So I left you a worksheet on page 57 if you'd like extra practice. And I'd be happy to come back and repeat some of this stuff on Monday if you'd like to hear some of it again. And for the last, say, 15 minutes or so, I'd like to introduce you to pages 58. Probably not 59, we'll probably just do 58. Does anyone need a picture of the board? If you need to get up, you're welcome to. Anybody else? Y'all good? Okay. Construct a capillary. How many tunicas or layers does a capillary have?
One.
One. Good. It's made up of simple squamous. It's called tunica intima. And that is why the capillary is our next conversation. It is the best place for us to talk about exchanges with the environment, you know, the surrounding cells and tissues, because it's made up of only one cell layer thickness. So what kind of vessel leads into a capillary? Arterioles, good. So at this end, we've got our arteriole bringing blood into your capillary. And at the opposite end, what kind of vessel drains your capillary network? Venule, good. Okay. So far, so good, right? Let's talk about water. Back way back in Bio210, I know you probably heard about where water is located in the body. Just want to establish that because today's topic is bulk fluid transport of water across the capillary wall. The capillary is an ideal location for it because we've got only one cell layer thickness, and it's easy to move water across the wall. Not by osmosis, but by the force of pressures pushing and pulling that water. So let's see, we've got water in two main locations. What is ICF?
Intracellular fluid.
So I'll stick some cells out here. Okay, and the second major compartment is ECF. And that is extracellular fluid. You know, about 2/3 is intracellular, about 1/3 is interstitial and extracellular fluids. Blood plasma is another one that's important in that category. So let's see, let's put plasma in the capillary. And let's place interstitial fluid out there between those cells and tissues. So the topic for today is how do we do exchange of fluids at the capillary? We call it bulk fluid exchange or bulk fluid transport here. And the capillary is the ideal location because it is a single cell wall thickness. You really can't do this when you're talking about arteries or veins. Their walls are too thick to support this kind of exchange. This is not osmosis. We are not necessarily just moving fluids with a gradient. It's more of a pressure battle that we see going on here to move fluids at the capillary. So there's two pressures that are battling. One we're already familiar with, it's called blood pressure. Now, the more fancy name for blood pressure is called blood hydrostatic pressure. What does hydro kind of say to you?
Hydro.
That is water, yeah. So how much of your blood plasma is water?
55%.
Yeah, about 55%. So that blood plasma is going to be a force that pushes fluids out of your capillary. So a couple of things to keep in mind here. Blood hydrostatic pressure is abbreviated as BHP. It is also called blood pressure, so we can say those terms interchangeably, meaning the same thing. So hydrostatic pressure is in your capillary. It is created by the fluids in your bloodstream, and it is the force that pushes fluids out of your bloodstream. feel like I'm announcing a fight here. In one corner we've got hydrostatic pressure, in another corner we've got osmotic pressure, and now we've got the battle that's getting ready to be set. Osmotic pressure is osmosis, and thinking back, what drives water movement when you talked about osmosis? Salts. Good, water follows salt. So that, keep that in mind, okay? And we're gonna add to that because it's not just salt that pulls water, it's also plasma proteins. So blood osmotic pressure is created by salts and proteins in your bloodstream. Thinking way back, you might have heard of albumin before. We know antibodies are plasma proteins, globulins. So those are going to be the ones that attract the movement of water toward them. And of course, this is a pressure that actually pulls fluids toward the higher concentration of salts and proteins. So I think you see the battle here is between the push of hydrostatic pressure and the pull of osmotic pressure. Are you so far so good? Okay, I'm gonna give you some numbers. Do not memorize the numbers. If they happen to stick in your brain, you can't get rid of them, no problem. But I'm not gonna ask you these numbers that I'm gonna share with you on the test. So just a few minutes ago, we talked about pressure really high in the aorta. It takes a nosedive in those arterioles. And when you get to your capillaries, I mentioned that the blood pressure comes in around mid-30s. So when we talk about blood hydrostatic pressure, we're really talking just about blood pressure. And it's about 35 millimeters mercury as we come in the arterial end of a capillary, okay? And because these capillaries have fenestrations or pores, that means that we've got spaces to push fluids out into that interstitial space. Think about it this way. If you've got a hose or a tire poked full of holes, what happens to the pressure?
It's going to go right on down.
Going to go right on down, so you lose pressure. By the time you reach the venule end of your capillary, you've lost so much pressure that you're in the mid-teens. Somewhere about 15 to 17 millimeters mercury, okay? So that's because you've got so much push behind this fluid, it's just being pushed out into these interstitial spaces. So that's part of the battle. The other half of the battle is the osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure is the pressure that pulls fluids toward what? Salts and protein, good. Now it's going to be a stable number. It's going to be around 26 millimeters mercury across the length of your capillary. So at the arterial end it's 26, at the venule end it's 26. So let's take the arterial end of your capillary first. The higher number wins the battle. We have a push of 35 and we have a pull only of 26. Who's your winner?
Push.
Okay, so yeah, you in fact will push fluids out here at this end. Okay, and we call this process of pushing fluids out a special name. It's called what? Actually, I do have it on there. It's filtration. Yeah, that push out is called filtration. So it is a pressure battle here, and the pressure that's the highest wins the battle. So you force fluids out at the arterial end thanks to high hydrostatic pressure. But, you know, by the time you reach the venule end, that force behind the blood pressure is going to really drop. We're down to mid-teens, about 15 to 17. And again, the higher pressure wins the battle. So at the venule end of your capillary, your BOP, your osmotic pressure, happens to be your higher pressure. So it's going to be the winner down here. And you'll note that its job is to pull fluids. So where are we pulling fluids from? Yeah, interstitial space, right? Pull it from the interstitial space back into your capillary, okay? And the name of this is called reabsorption. And so we filter fluids out at one end, we reabsorb them back in at the other end. On your sheet, there's something called NFP. You may notice that if you've got the course pack down near the bottom of page 58. NFP stands for net filtration pressure. And if you do the math here, if you're pushing out with 35 and you're pulling fluids in with 26, you're going to come up with about a net filtration pressure of 10. And I know you're saying, wait a minute, 35 minus 26 is 9, not 10. So how do you get 10 out of that? And the answer is, there's a tiny bit of pressure in your interstitial space that contributes to the calculation. It's not enough for us to really worry about, but I wanted to explain that we've got some bad math going on here. 35 minus 26, you're right, is 9. But include the little bit of pressure in the interstitial space, and that's how they get a net filtration pressure of 10 millimeters. So in reality, that's how much pushing power you've got at the arterial end of a capillary. Down here on the venule end of your capillary, you'll notice that is a negative number. And that's because we're pulling in with 26 millimeters, but we're pushing out with around 15 to 17. And now you're probably sitting there trying to figure out, how do we get 8 by subtracting 26 minus 17? And again, we're looking at the little bit of pressure that's in the interstitial space that contributes to the return of fluids back to your capillary. Okay, so NFP is net filtration pressure, and that's the overall push or pull power you've got at the arterial or venule end of your capillary. So I think I've given you hopefully enough tools to be able to look at page 59. If you'll complete that one as homework, I'll go over the answers with you in here on Monday. And then of course, we're gonna work on lymphatic system, and that's gonna be a very short chapter for us to work through. All right, y'all have a great weekend. Sure, I'm gonna turn off that recorder.